better world is a-coming. Tell you why. There's a better world is a-coming. Tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world is a-coming. Tell you why. Better world is a-coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world is a-coming, don't you see?
Good evening. This is your host, News Director Rick Spezak. I want to welcome you to another Progressive News Network. We've got some really good guests for you tonight. We've got Anna Vishkeki Eskamani, who is going to be talking to us about women's suffrage and the ongoing struggle for women's equality. Linda Saint, who's going to be talking to us about access to medical care. Rebecca Marquez of Oceana, who's going to be talking to us about those dangerous sonic boom testing under the water up and down the East Coast from Delaware to Florida. They're doing this, of course, for the endless search for oil. And it doesn't matter very little that it's going to basically destroy the hearing and thus mobility and ability to eat food. And anyway, it's going to damage the cetaceans, dolphins, whales, porpoises, etc., up and down the East Coast from Delaware to Florida. Then we've got Alan Mackey, who's a union official and activist in the Midwest, who's going to talk to us about the issues of war and peace. We've got Keith McHenry, one of the founders of Food Not Bombs, who's going to be talking to us about feeding the hungry and homeless in times of peace and war. And then we've got Ms. Leah Barber-Hines, from Florida Chain, who's going to be talking to us about getting access to this new healthcare program that's going to be rolling out in October. And exciting news, lots of new information, and the navigators will be there to help you. And as a special guest, talking about the issues of war and peace, we've got Brian Stetton, a progressive activist and web journalist with Progress Toward Democracy. He's going to be on, and also Sandy Davis, longtime peace activist and PDA leader, Progressive Democrats of America leader in the Miami area. So, with that good news, I got to tell you, it's a heck of a show. Wait till you hear it. Also, next week, we're going to have a union show for Labor Day. Lots of good activities going on across the country, and we want you to hear all about it, so we're going to do our Labor Day show next week. So we'll be extending the celebration of the working men and working women who make this country great. Okay, the news. Oh my goodness, there's so much news out of TEPCO. That show's going to need to be another full show again sometime soon. This news first. Tokyo. Japan's nuclear regulator on Wednesday upgraded the rating of the leak of radiation-contaminated water from a tank at its tsunami-wrecked nuclear plant to a serious incident on the international scale, and it castigated the plant operator for failing to catch the problem earlier. The Nuclear Regulation Authority's latest criticism of Tokyo's electric power company came a day after the operator of Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant acknowledged a 300-ton leak probably began nearly a month and a half before it was discovered on August 19th. Boy, they have 300-ton leaks like some people have crabgrass, I guess. Okay. In a meeting with agency officials Tuesday night, TEPCO said radioactivity near the leak and exposure levels among patrolling staff started to increase in early July. There's no sign that anyone tried to even find the source of the radioactivity before the leak was discovered. On Wednesday, regulatory officials said TEPCO has repeatedly ignored their instructions to improve their patrolling procedures to reduce the risk of overlooking leakages. They also said that TEPCO underestimated the potential impact of the leaks because underground water is shallower around the tank than the company initially told regulators. Now, keep that in mind. Shallower around the tank, shallower than the company initially told regulators. In other words, the groundwater is very close to the surface. And in fact, if there's standing water, because there's leaks everywhere, well, I'll leave that to your imagination, because certainly the science isn't being reported. Earlier this week, Japan's industry minister said the government will take over cleanup. The authority originally gave a level 1 preliminary rating and anomaly to the tank leak. Last week, the authority proposed raising it to a level 3. A serious incident, and it made that change after consulting with the International Atomic Agency, Atomic Energy Agency. The IAEA's ratings are designed to inform the international community, and changing them does affect the effort to clean up the leak by the government and TEPCO. 2011 Fukushima disaster was rated a maximum of 7 on the scale of the same as the 1986 Chernobyl accident, which thank goodness everyone's already forgotten about, except the people, of course, that are still being impacted by it. What's important is not the number itself, but give a basic idea about the extent of the problem, said Authority Chairman Shunichi Tanaka. I've seen reports that this is a dire situation. That's not true. Tanaka said there's a much larger ongoing problem at the plant, massive amounts of contaminated groundwater reaching the sea. But that problem can't even be rated under the IAEA's International Nuclear and Radiological Event Scale because it is unknown exactly how much groundwater is escaping, how contaminated it is, and what effect it's having on sea and marine products. Oh, maybe some data would be handy here. TEPCO has recovered some of the water leaked from the tanks, but says some of it may have reached the sea through the rainwater gutter. Yeah, nobody noticed the rainwater gutter. TEPCO has built hundreds of tanks to hold radioactive water, some of which is groundwater that made its way into the plant. But hundreds more tons of contaminated water are believed to be entering the sea each day. The plant suffered multiple meltdowns after a massive earthquake and tsunami in March 2011. TEPCO is putting tons of water into its reactors to cool them and is struggling to contain the resulting waste water. Now, the radiation, the nuclear plant meltdown, occurs at 4,800 degrees Fahrenheit, just under 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. TEPCO ignored on Wednesday. Regulatory officials said TEPCO has repeatedly ignored their instructions to improve the patrolling. Okay, let me jump ahead. There's no scrutiny for you. Police forces around the world have had a problem that when their officers can be carried away and start pepper spraying tied up captives, there's someone on hand filming the event on their mobile phones. When sick police lay into prone grannies on the floor with long batons, the pictures can be on the net in seconds, meaning the supervisors will have to answer embarrassing questions. They may not need to fear much longer. Apple has patented a piece of technology which would allow government and police to block the transmission of information, including video and photographs, whenever they like. All the copper has to do is decide that a public gathering or venue is deemed sensitive, needs to be protected from externalities. Apple will switch off all its gear. Hey, sounds like freedom of speech to me. Okay, so is this part of the whole journalism as a terrorist activity? I don't know. I know that our friend Harry Shearer talks about wanton journalism, which is one of the things that journalists are charged with nowadays. The police can then get on with their heavy task of kettling protesters without having to worry about a few pictures of people being beaten. Apple insists the affected sites are mostly cinemas, theaters, concert grounds and similar location, but does admit that it could be used in covert police or government operations that may require a complete blackout condition. Okay. yes, they can turn your phone off when they want to. Face the future. Speaking of faces and saving faces and watching the red lines, police surveillance, New York Times recently reported that the Department of Homeland Security is developing 3D facial recognition surveillance systems. According to documents released through the FOIA request by the Electronic Privacy Information Center, the technology is intended to allow the government to collect, store, and compare images in a variety of situations in order to identify persons on federal watch lists. Hey, how about that? In a test last fall, the biometric optical surveillance system, BOSS, I guess it's the big BOSS, has not achieved the level of speed and accuracy yet required. Woohoo. Coming soon at a theater near you. And, okay. It now raises significant questions as Americans become increasingly distrustful of the federal government's surveillance practices, particularly in the wake of Edward Snowden's revelation about the NSA's vast electronic surveillance programs. Perhaps most troubling and yet unsurprising is the privacy safeguards are not mentioned once. Nope. Not mentioned once in the documents. Woohoo! Now, for those of you who want some more information and lots more details, if you go to my website, www.averyvoice.com, it'll show you the information of tonight's show. There's lots more details, including there'll be a link to a RAND research company, a research report they did for the U.S. Army called the Long War Program. Let's see here. It is technically called Unfolding the Future of the Long War. Ooh, boy, doesn't that sound like fun to you? Well, it sets up basically the plan where the U.S. and its allies will be taking over so that they can then control the entire Middle East from Afghanistan and Pakistan in the east all the way out there to the coast. So Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, you just ask, and they'll be taking it over pretty soon. So this RAND research document lists the short description of the eight trajectories discussed in this report. There's the steady state, the baseline case, largely reminiscent of current actions and environment. In this sense, the threat continues to be broad universe of radical Salafi jihadists, including both transnational and sometimes regional groups. War of ideas shift to information-based campaign with the goal of isolating jihadists and their infrastructure from the broader global Muslim population, plan to confront Iran militarily over its nuclear programs or shelved for the time being. Number three, major Muslim nation goes bad. A radical shift in regime brought on when a critical state in the Muslim world is taken over by radical extremists. So the most plausible, most threatening scenarios to American interests would be a military coup in Pakistan or a successful fundamentalist insurgency in Saudi. That brings us to the next one, conflict arising between jihadists leads the U.S. to take a divide-and-conquer approach in order to exploit cleavages among transnational jihadists. Yeah, this is the whole war plan, so it's a pretty interesting document in case you're trying to make sense out of what the hell's going on and the lies you're being told. Well, let's bring on our first guest, Ms. Anna Fishke Eskamani, who's going to talk to us about women's suffrage and the ongoing battle for full human rights for women. Anna, welcome.
Oh, hi. How are you doing, Rick?
Very good. Very good. And yourself?
Doing fantastic. I actually just got out of a college Democrat meeting here at the University of Central Florida. So just stepped out to take this call, especially for you and your audience.
Well, we sure appreciate it. I know you're such a busy girl. You've graduated, now you're back in grad school, you're a volunteer, you work for a not-for-profit agency, the Young Democrats, it's fantastic. Why don't you tell us about that women's suffrage event you did on, was it Wednesday?
Yeah, it was on Wednesday, and so as most of you know, it was Women's Equality Day on August 26th, which is a celebration of women's suffrage. And believe it or not, you know, women have not been voting for that long of a time. The 19th Amendment was passed in 1920. And here at UCF, every year we celebrate the women's suffrage movement with a march. And so this was our fourth one. I remember back when I was a junior at UCF, we had our first women's suffrage march. And it was an incredible day, but it was, a kind of a small event that we did. And it has built every year since then. And so at this last March, we had over 65 students in attendance. We had incredible keynote speakers, including the Women's Studies Program Director here at UCF, Dr. Maria Santana. We had our SGA president speak, and we also had the phenomenal Val Demings, who, as you know, is the first female Lando police chief, and she also ran for Congress against Dan Webster and we hope for her to run again in the near future. And so the whole theme of our Women's Suffrage March this year was encouraging minority women to run, because though we have celebrated, you know, 2012 as being a year of women in regards to elected representation, we still only have 20 women senators. And when it comes to representation of diversity, it is lacking. And so we were encouraged not only women to vote, but also women to run for office and for women of color to run for office.
You know, it's so important because I know when I was teaching college classes, you talk about contemporary politics of things going on, and you often wonder if people appreciate just how fresh this history is. And if they're not paying attention to contemporary politics, they wouldn't necessarily even recognize how on what thin ground some of the human rights progress is.
No, it's very true. I mean, the fact that women have only been voting since 1920 in this country should be a shock to many. And then when we look at Women's Equality Day at the broader picture, I mean, talking about economics anyways, you know, women are far from being economically equal. I mean, it has a lot to do with not just the fact that, you know, women are paid less per dollar, despite the fact that we might have the same education as our male counterparts, even the same job as our male counterparts. There are other issues that impact women in a very unique way, including minimum wage. Women account for 2/3 of the country's minimum wage workers. And so what that means is when we have the federal floor of $7.25, it only brings in about $14,000 a year for women who are going to be working full time. They're going to be mothers. You know, being a mom and is a second job for most people. And so that again creates a gender wage gap in our society. And so there's so much more to it besides the fact that, you know, women haven't had the opportunity to be politically active in a strong way since 1920.
You know, I was wondering. You know, it's such a good thing to do to bring this to people's attention. And, you know, clearly college is the time to help people understand this so that they can go off into the rest of their life with the benefit of that understanding. But, you know, I wonder, there's got to be think tanks puzzling over the problem. How do we encourage, you know, good economic progress and at the same time not ignore biological realities in terms of, you know, some of the childbearing and some of that child care. That's a biological reality. And our culture is so unprepared, it seems, yet to face that reality. Child care is not readily available.
Yes,
job flexibility.
And that's what I was going to add is that, you know, having high quality child care being accessible. I think that is incredibly, incredibly needed in our society. One in five families today feature a male breadwinner and a stay-at-home mom. But yet, child care for an infant and a four-year-old costs more than the median rent in every state in this country. I mean, the cost of child care is incredibly expensive, and putting that burden, you know, on our families is creating, again, a gap of equality for women. And so, you know, we really need to consider, like you already alluded to, you know, having child care be more accessible. You know, giving workers fair time away when they're sick or when their children are sick. We saw the Earned Sick Time campaign here in Orange County, which is still an ongoing battle. And this would have helped women in such a powerful way, for women to be able to take that time off when their child needs them. And so they don't have to be fired from their job because they have to leave work early to pick up their child from school who's throwing up, you know. And so there are so many different policies that we can enact that could really change our culture and the way that, you know, women face equality in their everyday lives.
Well, I mean, we're both progressives. I'm sure you see some of the improved and more humane practices over in France or over in Germany or in some of the Swedish countries. It goes a good long way, but not even that isn't perfect. I mean, if you were to just fantasize from in the ideal situation, I think you'd have to say something like funds for stay-at-home moms have to be somehow found. That the child care worker, whether in a preschool or an after school or an in school, have to be paid a real wage that somehow represents the value that we are demanding. It's just either we're 100 miles from that.
I think you bring up a few very good points. I mean, first of all, you know, we don't add value to the time that a woman spends at home with their children. And that is probably, you know, if we were going to quantify that hourly, I'm sure the time it, you know, puts into raising a child is going to be way above, you know, minimum wage. I mean, we don't put any type of financial attachment to that or financial value. And from a theoretical perspective, that, again, is creating a level of inequality for women in the work that we do. But then I also add that when we do try to enact policies, they don't pass because there's a lack of understanding of them. And, for example, in Florida, Senator General Lee Thompson right here in Central Florida tried to sponsor a bill that would basically make the discrimination of a pregnant woman illegal. And it was a bill that was not deemed controversial by any means and makes a lot of sense to a lot of people, especially those who have been mothers in the workplace, and yet that did not pass. And even something as simple as that, it wasn't asking for any type of financial support, wasn't enacting a new tax, really just trying to make being pregnant in the workplace something that is acceptable and something that is not discriminated against, and that did not pass.
It's beyond absurd. I just saw a little note on Facebook the other day about another case where a woman was arrested for breastfeeding, and you know, the hypocrisy of the sexualization of everything, from automobiles to children, and at the same time, there's this totally nonsensical, you know, failure to understand basic human biology, and it seems to be a inability to permeate some of these Neanderthals' heads, you know? We have to make a real effort in your generation and the next generation that we can turn these things around. There has to be some kind of intelligent dialogue about this. I think that the battle for reasonable wages for the food service people is really part
definitely.
Of that same battle.
No, definitely. Definitely. And I think in almost every issue you look at, we can see, you know, the role that gender plays. And it's just something that, like you said, all generations need to be involved in this conversation. I mean, we have first-wave feminists, second-wave feminists, and third-wave feminists who, you know, if we all come together, can really send a strong signal to fight for these issues. And so I think we have seen progress in the local level, right? Like, we're seeing women, pick up leadership positions and make attempts to run for office. Oftentimes, you know, successful, sometimes not, but still getting back up and running again. But I think it requires more of that. I mean, more women kind of, not accepting the status quo and stepping up to take charge. And I can say from the perspective of being a Florida activist and advocate, I'm seeing that happen every day, and I'm inspired by it, especially by a lot of the younger students. I know, I'm pretty young myself, but I'm looking at the freshmen here at UCF.
Oh, you're an old hand.
I feel like I'm much older, sir. But looking at the younger generation beneath me, I mean, there's so much passion and a new perspective on the world, and I credit that a lot to the internet making information more accessible to all of us. And so I think the movement is starting. I mean, for a women's suffrage march here locally at UCF, there are many new faces, many firsts march and their introduction to being an activist. And so I definitely think that we are changing the conversation. That really is the first step to any movement, is to have that conversation.
Well, just for a little kind of appreciation of the distance. My grandmother was first generation in this country from Slovakia, and she never felt, even though she graduated from school, she never felt she knew enough about the world to be comfortable voting. So she never voted. And she lived to her mid-90s, and she passed away in the early 2000s. But I think, in one generation, how it goes from that to my parents' generation, my generation, now my children's generation. And, you see that kind of progress and you think, wow, that's really a positive thing. But these some of these things that have not yet left the table, I mean, access to birth control, access to medical health. What we see this left and right across the country being, forced backwards by reactionary forces that, seem to be unable to comprehend simple biology.
And I also just want to add to that that there really is a greater conversation around intersectionality and the fact that, you know, this isn't just an issue about gender. It's an issue about color, about sexuality, and really understanding, you know, the elements of society in a holistic way and taking all these parts into consideration. And I know, you know, from the perspective of reproductive justice, I mean, you know, lack of access for all women is very real, but in communities of color, it's even more real. And so kind of acknowledging that fact and trying to identify, you know, why is that? Why are communities of color having higher HIV rates? Why are teen pregnancy rates dropping across the country except for, you know, people who are in poverty and those who are in communities of color? And so really addressing these issues in a more, you know, macro way, I think is the way that we should all do it in order to really create social change.
You know, it's interesting here. Orlando also hosted the ALEC conference. So here we've got this wonderful echo that you did to remind people about how this we must work every day for human rights and human liberty and women's rights. And yet you have this conclave of medievalists. The ironies are thick and fast. So tell me, what's coming up for the world of college Democrats and the good progressives of Orlando?
Well, we have we are always moving forward here at UCF and in Central Florida, and so we've already been kickstarting a lot of our local campaigns. I know the weeks ahead we see a lot of campaign kickoffs for Senator Geraldine Thompson, Representative Randolph Bracey, Representative Joe Saunders. We're really starting to see these campaigns pick up. We've already been doing canvases for two of our local candidates in Orange and Seminole County. And so when it comes to, you know, 2014, we're already fired up and ready to go. We also had a rally last week because Americans for Prosperity, and I say that with quotation marks, had a summit
from here.
Here in Central Florida. And so one of our local activist groups organized now. We hosted a rally, and we had Jenna Tosh, Planned Parenthood of Orlando President and CEO, be the keynote speaker for that event. And we really talked about the Affordable Care Act and how important it is that the ACA is here to stay. And so probably our next steps forward is to focus on enrollment, which will open October 1st, and we're working with Enroll America to make sure that, you know, we reach our goal of 7 million Americans being enrolled with the Affordable Care Act. And among that, you know, in regards to the on-campus action, we have Hispanic Heritage Month coming up. We have a Pride rally coming up. And so, you know, there is no time to rest. And I have to say.
Hello? Whoops, we must have lost our good friend, Miss Escamani. Well, okay. Well, we should have our friend Linda on in just a little while. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this a little bit and remind you of something we ought to try. Okay, all we are saying is give peace a chance. I'm going to play our interview with Mr. Alan Mock. And he is talking about the issues of war and peace we're facing. Hello, this is Richard Spezak, Progressive News Network. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty good. Alan, why don't you give us your title, if you would, sir?
Well, I'm the director of organizing for the Midwest Casino Workers Organizing Council.
Thank you, sir. I know you've been a longtime peace activist. Like so many of us, you've opposed war after war after war after war. I was wondering what your perspective is, sir. Why is it, do you think, that the president isn't trying to do something other than just attack? Why do you think he has this idea that, well, once he announces it, that's it, there's no debate. Where has our democracy gone, sir?
Well, we don't have much democracy when it comes to decisions over war and peace. The American people have no say whatsoever. I've been watching the news and everything and listening to what people have to say, and it seems to me the majority of the people in this country are totally opposed to going into any kind of war against Syria. And there's no reason for bombing Syria. Even if gas was used, and we don't know that it was used or who used it, but even if it was used, it makes absolutely no sense to bomb a people with cruise missiles and everything else because of this. You know, how does killing more people help the situation at all? All it does is further destabilize the entire situation in the Middle East.
Well, we've got Iraq in a mess, Iran in a mess, the continuing blockades there. We're saber-rattling more and more. Lebanon has got spillover from the war in Syria. Turkey's got spillover from the war in Syria. Seems that the only people there who really want a war, want more war, I hate to say it, looks like the Israelis to me. Why is it that do they think that this is going to benefit somebody? Whether we destabilize Syria's Assad and what, hand this broken state over to warring militias? Is that the good plan?
Well, that is Obama's plan, and that's been the CIA's plan all along. They've done the same thing in country after country. They did it in Yugoslavia. They did it in Iraq. They did it in Libya. They're doing it in Yemen. They're putting people, they're setting people against one another. Then they call it a civil war, but it's the CIA that's been instigating all of this. The reason for this is because destabilization is required in order for Wall Street to monopolize and control that area of the world to keep getting the oil out of that area. If these wars weren't going on, the people would get together and they would be living in more or less a peaceful state. And they don't want that because once people begin to live in a peaceful state, they begin to say, you know, these are our resources and you're not going to steal our resources. And if you want our resources, you're going to pay us, a legitimate price for them. Wall Street doesn't want to pay anybody for anything. Wall Street wants everything for free. And that's why the Middle East is in a destabilized situation right now. This is terrible. To think that the President of the United States would launch cruise missiles against the people under the auspices that this gas has been used is just, it's impossible to find the words to describe it. It's just the epitome of everything that's indecent. And, that the American people should be out in the streets protesting and demanding that this country not go to war. That American people don't want war and they're going to have to get out in the streets and insist that there be no war. That's the only way these wars are going to end. We're just going to have war after war after war. And the money that's being spent, even Robert Reich came out and said that, these wars are causing poverty. The wars and militarism are causing poverty. He came out with that statement today. And there's more and more people that are beginning to see the sense having an end to these wars and reaping a peace dividend, which will provide things that people really need in this country, like health care. And health care would create many jobs if we have a national public health care system. We need child care in this country really bad. We could have a national public child care system, which would create 3 to 5 million jobs. That could be paid for with peace dividends. We just had a huge march in Washington for jobs and freedom. How the heck can we get jobs in this country while we're wasting all this money on wars? It's impossible.
Alan, it seems to me that the old axiom that, well, people came out and protested against Vietnam because they had skin in the game, but it's been a long time since there's been a draft. We saw huge, massive, worldwide protests against the Iraq war, but that didn't stop anything. Do you think the powers that be have basically taught the average person that protesting makes no difference?
Well, I think to some extent people have the feeling that they can't fight City Hall and win. But on the other hand, I think what we have to realize is that we're going to have to challenge Wall Street for power. These wars are the direct result of a Wall Street agenda that promotes these wars in order to protect their interests and their assets overseas. And unless we challenge this and challenge Wall Street for power with our own people's kinds of politicians that will put peace first, we're not going to see any changes. And I think that the American people are beginning to realize this, And Occupy Wall Street was one example, and that's why Barack Obama sent over 500 FBI agents into Occupy Wall Street to disrupt it. So now we've got to begin to build on what the real sentiment of the American people is. And the American people have realized that Wall Street is our enemy, just like people all over the world are realizing that Wall Street is the enemy, along with the G8, the financial centers, the Square Mile in London, the Bay Street in Canada. These financial centers are the enemies of the peoples of the world. And Wall Street is the first and foremost, and unless we challenge Wall Street for power, we're not going to end these wars, and we're not going to be reordering the priorities in this country the way they need to be.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for your thoughts, sir. Let's hope that cooler heads prevail. Let's hope that they come up with some other alternative than more weapons into a country that's already torn terribly. Thank you again, sir.
Thanks, Rick.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Alan Mackey with his insight into the situation with the wonderful decision the president has made. Hopefully he'll listen to the people's representatives, the people who carry the voice of Americans to Congress to speak to the president, and let's hope the cooler heads prevail. Meanwhile, on a cooler topic entirely, I'm going to bring you Miss Rebecca Marquez of Oceana, who's going to talk to us about that offshore testing. Take it away, Rebecca. Hello, is this Rebecca Marquez?
Yes, it's Rebecca.
And this is Rebecca of the Florida Campaign Organizer for Climate and Energy?
Yes, for Oceana, and I'm very excited to be here, so thank you.
So, Rebecca, you've got some really interesting forums coming up. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. Well, right now, of course, as you know, we've been working tirelessly against seismic air gun testing. And for those of you who may not be well-versed in what seismic air gun testing is, it's a dangerous procedure to look for oil and gas beneath the ocean floor. And this procedure is really dangerous for two main reasons. One, because, of course, it leads to offshore drilling, and right now it is going to look for oil and gas in an area from Delaware all the way to Florida. And the whole scope of this area is twice the size of California. So these are the areas that they're going to be looking to perform offshore drilling next. And as you know, and everybody knows, offshore drilling is dirty and dangerous and unnecessary. And as we remember here in Florida with the BP spill in 2010, it can have disastrous consequences, not just to wildlife, but also our local communities and economy. So as you can see, from Delaware to Florida, that's a huge area that these oil companies want to be tapping into at, of course, our expense. The second reason why seismic air gun testing is really dangerous is because of the threat that the procedure itself lends it to marine animals. And right now, with the Department of Interior, their own estimates are that 138,500 dolphins and whales will be injured or killed from this testing. And with the recent influx of dolphin deaths, of course, you know that we cannot put any of these wildlife at risk again in any kind of way. So it's a really important issue to really be working on right now, and a really key one in where our country is headed to in our energy future. So we've actually, Rick, I don't know if you've heard yet, but we actually just had a recent reason for celebration, and not too much celebration because, of course, we still have to work on this really hard. But the Department of Interior and BOEM, who's the group that's going to be heading the environmental impact statement for seismic air gun testing, has pushed back their deadline on the final EIS another few months, all the way to 2014. So this is the third time we've effectively helped to push back this final environmental impact statement, which, of course, the further we can push that back, the bigger of a case we can make against it, get more public involved against this. So every month is really critical in this fight right now. So what we're doing, our next step here in Florida specifically, but really all along the East Coast with all of our other organizers in each state, is we're holding these events called seismic air gun aired in educational forums. And the reason why these forums are really exciting is because we're going to have a panel of experts in different communities all across the East Coast. So right now we have 10 locations talking about this issue and telling the public exactly from, you know, known voices that are experts in a lot of cases and incredible people, telling them exactly why seismic air gun testing is dangerous and unnecessary. And here in Florida, we have two events coming up, and one in Jacksonville on September 30th and one in Miami on October 3rd. And there's going to be details to come, including our panel, who's on it. But I can tell you that Jacksonville will be at the Jacksonville University, again, on September 30th from 6 to 8. And in Miami, it'll be at the University of Miami Rasmus campus from 7 to 9. And we have really exciting lineup. We're pulling all of our resources into this. We're really working hard to bring as many people out as possible to these, and the bigger showing, the better. And of course, we're working with coalition partners. Surfrider has been really great so far with us, and working on some with the Sea Shepherds in Jacksonville, and really looking to, you know, expand as wide of a net with coalition partners and people in the community, and really get local voices speaking out against this. So with that, you know, I just really would encourage it, you know, anyone who's interested in either attending, or if you are someone who would be able to speak to this as well, contact me at rmarquez@oceana.org, and that's Marquez with an S, not a Z, or Oceana Florida on Facebook, and you can message us there or go to our website, www.oceana.org, and sign up as a volunteer, and you'll get all this information. And it's just, you know, this is a really critical time, Rick, and we're looking for everybody who can get involved to do so as soon as possible.
Rebecca, let me ask you this. I'm sure there's a petition out there, and they would find that petition, I guess, through the Facebook site as well as at the main Oceana site?
Absolutely. And if they haven't, if anyone has any questions, they can always message us on either our website or our personal email. And someone, is particularly probably me if you're in Florida, will get back to you as soon as possible. We do have a petition still going. We have an ongoing one. Just so you know, right now we have 140,000 people who across the country have signed one of our petitions against this. And that's not including Greenpeace has done another petition. And we have one on the White House website. So really at this point, we're in the couple hundred thousand of people who have taken a stand against this, and every single one counts, because next week one of our, you know, senior scientists is actually going to go meet with BOEM and present all the petitions we've gotten. So, you know, these petitions are not just thrown away, they're highly valuable, and they have helped us make a case against seismic since the beginning. So petitions matter, and thank you, everyone who has signed one of our petitions at one point, because it does make a huge difference.
Well, Rebecca, I want to thank you so much. This is so important. And for people who may not realize, dolphins, porpoises, whales, the cetaceans are absolutely dependent on their biological radar for location,
absolutely,
for feeding,
uh-huh,
for communications. And this process clearly deafens them, makes them blind, makes them unable to eat, find food, and navigate. It's a critical,
yeah,
matter. And to hear our oil industry given carte blanche to just blast incredibly loud sounds. I know in the past when you've been on, you've had an analogy,
yeah,
to the amount of the sound pressure that comes from this testing. Could you refresh our memory on that?
Absolutely. Just to get everybody to grasp, especially in water, of course, sound travels more intensely. So this is about 100,000 times louder than a jet engine in the water to these animals. And like you said, hearing is so important to these animal survival. And we actually have a saying called a deaf whale is a dead whale, or a deaf dolphin is a dead dolphin. And as you can imagine, that's how important your hearing is. So if we took that into our context, imagine if a jet engine is flying over your head every 10 seconds, every minute, every hour for days to weeks on end in just one area alone. Now take that as your main source of survival depends on your hearing. And when you think of this, I mean, it's just devastating to these whole populations. And here in Florida, you know, we have the right whale. It's endangered. And the Department of Interior, again, said probably at least 9 right whales will be injured or killed through this process. So this really will have devastating effects. And again, it's just completely unnecessary. And it's purely because of oil and gas industry when we have cleaner methods of renewable energy available. And for this to really happen is not just a political failure, or and it's an also an economic failure, because it will certainly affect fisheries, which for some reason the Department of Interior is not including the impact that this will have on fisheries and other marine life that are not just mammals, which we believe the reason for that is probably because it'll get a lot of fishing groups up in arms, because it could really impact some fishing communities and businesses really negatively here. And so it's really just going to be devastating all around. And again, it's unnecessary. So it's also a moral failure on top of all of that.
Let me ask you this, Rebecca, and it actually may not be unknowable. Is there one particular or a consortium of energy companies that are doing this, or is it being done through a third party? So I'm thinking, you know, can we say let's boycott X oil company because they're the ones doing it? Do we know who's doing it, or is it, like I say, a third party that's giving them some breathing space that way?
Yes, I don't have that information. We do know that I believe there were 9 petitioning bodies for the seismic air gun to be done, and they're usually, if oil companies very rarely will say, you know, Shell wants this or BP. It's done through,
sweetheart,
you know, oil, petroleum,
exploration companies or something.
Yes, exploration groups that, of course, they just have funneled money, just copious amounts of it compared to what we're fighting with, to these groups that really, you know, just go and shake your politicians' hands, go and shake, you know, everybody in every government sector's hands, because that's their main job, is just to make sure that every wish by these oil companies and gas companies is met. And that's what it really, it comes down to. So it's not really just, you know, even if it was just one oil company specifically doing that, it's really the whole system of how it's been brought. You know, these oil companies are going to put their profit over the livelihoods of Americans, and definitely over the livelihoods of marine life. So, you know, to me, it's not just ever about one oil company. It's more about how this whole prioritization of the oil industry's needs over Americans' needs, that's really what's dangerous about this.
Well, thank you so much, Rebecca. I sure appreciate it. Why don't you go ahead and give the website one more time?
Absolutely. www.oceana.org, and you can find our local page on Facebook at Oceana Florida.
Well, thanks again, Rebecca. Keep up the good work, and we're pulling for you.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, that was Rebecca Marquez, and we want you to pay attention to the Oceana site and the email you get from them, because that event's coming up in October, and it's so important, those of us who can speak up for the dolphins, the whales, the porpoises, that we do that. We are their voices on the shore. We have to speak up for them. I'm told by one of my guests that the phone system is in a faulty condition. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and play our next interview. This is with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. He's one of the original founders. And so that you know what Food Not Bombs is about, they're an organization who, when faced with the Vietnam War many, many years ago, said, you know, we do these wars, and of course, as you may have heard, it had a great impact on what was called the Great Society, the improvements the Johnson administration had tried to make. And there were more people being fed. There was more access to childcare. There were some really positive things that had happened. But the Vietnam War was impacting what could be done with these welfare programs. And human welfare programs. So consequently, Food Not Bomb said, well, it's the priorities that are wrong. Feeding the hungry is the right thing to do. In a rich country, we shouldn't have people starving. Not grown-ups, not elders, not children. No one should be starving in the streets. So they started Food Not Bombs, and it continues to this day. So ladies and gentlemen, I wanted to talk to Keith McHenry, one of the founders, because here, once again, we are told that the only alternative is war, and that's never the case. Hello, Keith. This is Rick Spezak, Progressive News Network. How are you doing, sir?
Very good.
I'm really glad to hear that, Keith. Your organization, Food Not Bombs, is doing such wonderful work and yet remains under attack. There are people trying to shut down feeding of the poor. I want to ask you a question, sir, about our national priorities. Why do you think it is that we can afford another war in Syria, but we can't afford to feed people or clothe people or house people? What do you think about the priorities? You've been looking at this for a long time.
Well, I think it's outrageous that we would waste billions. You know, some of these cruise missiles, they're thinking of using, even if it's a limited strike, would be equivalent to entire city budgets, like the city of San Francisco, for instance. So to waste all this money while we have 1 in 2 Americans struggling to survive, and then to threaten basically the stability of our economy over this, say if gas prices go up, people are going to have to make a choice between buying gasoline or buying that afternoon's dinner. And it could be such that many, many more people will go hungry as a direct result of this conflict.
You know, it seems awfully odd to me that we're told again and again and again that austerity is the only way to go. We have to trim our budgets. We have to cut back on schools. Texas says they're not even able to afford paving their roads, and yet they have a huge energy boom there. And now we're told that while we can't afford funding for schools or health care, we can afford to start a new war because, hey, that's going to go all right. Gosh, it went so well before. Are you convinced that the case has been made that we have no alternative but to start bombing this country?
Absolutely not. It's really outrageous. It's, I don't really know the facts needless to say, but it's my understanding, according to the Wall Street Journal this morning, that the Obama administration tried to keep the United Nations weapons inspectors from going to find out the details of this chemical weapons attack. And unfortunately, what that means is that it will be a war under false pretenses again, like the Iraq War, although this one, I fear, will be much worse. We're seeing a continued conflict in Libya after that war, which wasted billions of dollars, several billion dollars on that. And we're still, having a crisis in Afghanistan and Iraq. It just continues and continues. And with 50 cents of every tax dollar already going to the military, you know, how can we really afford to waste so much money while we have so many problems here? You know, we're about to face huge cuts in food stamps. At the same time that we do have money for the farm bill to large corporations like Monsanto, and our priorities are just completely crazy. And the thing that really upsets me the most is, you know, we're Food Not Bombs activists are dedicated to nonviolent direct action to change society. And we go out and we share free food and information on the streets, and so we see an ever-increasing number of people who are going hungry. Some people even have approached us saying they haven't eaten in 5 days here in the United States. And yet on the anniversary of I Have a Dream speech by probably the most prominent nonviolent activist in U.S. history, Martin Luther King Jr., our president, unfortunately the first African-American president, is now talking about a war that's completely baseless. You know, it's just outrageous. We know that we've been funding, and the Russians have been funding this war for quite some time, have been dumping weapons into both sides. It's a conflict that really only benefits the war machine, the wealthy military contractors. And now if we go into this, it's just horrible. And it could, of course, as many commentators are saying, lead to a greater conflict. It could be almost a global war. if Obama goes forward. So I really hope that sanity arrives, but it does not look good. And I would really wish everybody to get out in the streets and say, no, you know, Americans are overwhelmingly against this war. And yet within a couple of days, we went from no war to total war. And it's just absolutely outrageous.
Keith, so that we get a little bit of good news, where are you working feeding people this week?
Well, I myself will be providing food at a couple of events this Labor Day weekend. And one is our regular meal, which actually is at also coincides with the Taos, New Mexico protest against the U.S. attack on Syria. And then young people from the Pueblo and from Taos High School have organized an event called Regeneration, which we will be providing food at on Monday. But what's also amazing is Funabombs is sharing food in over 1,000 cities of the world. And there will be meals shared all over the United States this weekend and in every corner of the world. And the other thing is that many Funabombs groups like ours here are organized, have been growing vegetables in our Food Not Lawns garden. And so there is just a lot of energy going on. And we have, for instance, here in Taos, the Food Not Lawns Free School, and we've had a number of people from all over the world come through, study gardening, activism skills, and puppet making, things like that, and they have returned home, and they're doing organizing. And so, you know, I think Food Not Lawns is more prepared to support actions and demonstrations against this war and whatever economic fallout occurs than ever before.
Well, thank you so much, Keith. I really appreciate it, and we appreciate the work that you do feeding the hungry. Thank you, Keith, of Food Not Bombs.
Thanks so much. Yeah, it's beautiful. Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. And that was Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. And as you can see, the peace work goes on. It continues. And one of the reasons why I feel so good and can face every day is because I know that there are good people doing good work every day to make this a better world. There is a better world coming. And the next one I've got coming up, we've got Miss Leah Barber-Hines of Florida Chain, and she's going to talk to us about the rollout of the new healthcare system that's rolling out in October. She'll have lots of details for you. She's going to talk about some health fairs coming up that are going to be encouraging people and helping them enroll. And they've got this these people who are going to help, and they are called navigators. So let's bring on Miss Leah Barber-Hines of Florida Chain and get the good news about the healthcare system. So here we go, Miss Leah Barber-Hines. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Ms. Leah Barber-Hines, Advocacy Director of Florida Chain. Leah, could you please explain to our listeners what Chain stands for?
Sure. Florida Chain is the Community Health Action and Information Network.
Wow, that sounds like a project with some pretty heavy lifting. How long have you been involved with Florida Community Health Action Information Network?
I've been with Motley, the position, for a year and a half, but I've been working with the wonderful healthcare advocates that are involved in Florida Chain for at least 10 to 12 years now.
Our healthcare is evolving. The President and Congress have made some new possibilities available to American citizens. Could you explain what's approaching in October?
I am happy to. This is a very, very exciting time for our nation. It's a historic time. And as we know, the Affordable Care Act has been up against quite a fight for a little while now, and also specifically in Florida. Our leaders have been quite resistant, even though the law is in place. So we're working very hard to make sure that implementation is smooth and that we have as much support as possible. And most importantly, to make sure that the people of Florida know what's coming and how they can access this very important new health care that will be available very soon. So on October 1st, the healthcare marketplace will open. this is where people will have the opportunity to shop and compare and contrast different healthcare plans at different levels. In the marketplace, there are required benefits, and many of these benefits have never been required before. So it's absolutely a new day. Insurance plans will no longer be allowed to deny you or your family coverage based on pre-existing conditions. We know that this has been a huge issue for a long time. The health plans in the marketplace are required to cover maternity care, prescriptions, doctor visits, hospitalizations, emergency room care. The costs are capped. Extremely important benefits are going to be coming. Another thing that's already in place now that people may not know about is very important preventive care that's already required of insurance plans, such as mammograms. So we know how important prevention is. So on October 1st, this marketplace will open. There will be what we call navigators, which are people that are going to be assisting consumers in how to shop and how to figure out what's best for their families situated around the state. And we are very excited to get going. This is the real, true implementation of the law. And it's very important that we let the public know that this is available so that people can get in and start shopping and find out what they can do for their families, for many of them for the first time ever.
Yes, the costs of health care have been just an insurmountable battle for so many, both the working poor and the professional poor, if you will, those who have while it looks like a white-collar job from one side, it certainly the pay isn't what white-collar jobs used to be. Tell me, this marketplace, there's been so much confusion. And of course, the Republican propaganda has been awash in so much of the media. Yeah, what they've tried 30 or 40 times to stop Obamacare. While we know for sure that the Florida legislature has not been in any way helpful, how does that all shake out for Floridians? This healthcare marketplace, is it a state marketplace? Is it an online marketplace? How do we approach it, and how do we get the help of these navigators who are there, as you said, to help us understand the system?
These are all very good questions. One of the most important things that I want to say first as it relates to cost is the other piece of the marketplace that's so important for Floridians is that there will be help to pay for the cost depending on eligibility of income levels. So what that means is, just like you said, the white-collar job is not what it used to be. And there are many, you know, middle-class type families now that are having just as much trouble as low income in being able to afford even basic health care.
Sure.
So there will be tax credits that will be available to families to help with some of the costs. So that's extremely important for you to know. This is considered a marketplace that's being facilitated by the federal government. I'm sure that everyone has heard a lot in the news about this. Some states have their marketplaces being run by the state. Some places have it being run by the federal government. To begin with, ours will be run by the federal government, but down the road, we hope that will change. It's most importantly, this will be available no matter who's running it, because this law has been passed and it's here to stay, and there's not much anybody can do. With that, cooperation from state leaders is important. It is important for it to run smoothly, so we're watching very closely on implementation. What are the things that the state needs to be doing? Are they doing those things? And if we think they're not, we're making sure to make a lot of noise about that. That's one of the things that Florida Chain does, and we do that with a lot of our partners. So we're watching very closely, but what the public needs to know is this is going to happen on October 1st, no matter who's running it. It really is a public-private partnership with health insurance companies. There are some people that, like you said, with the propaganda that want to talk about this government-sponsored care. These are private health insurance companies, very well-known private health insurance companies that are going to be providing this health insurance. The government piece is that they are now going to have required benefits that are extremely important, and they can no longer discriminate against you because, you know, for example, because you're a woman, women have always had to pay more, and now the gender rating is not allowed. So there's all kinds of very important things like that are built into this. In terms of the navigators, they are going to be located all over the state, and we will have that information available, and as will the federal government. Healthcare.gov is the website where people can go now and get information. There's also a call number on that website on the home page where people can go and ask questions, but there will be a comprehensive list available of navigators so that people can see where they're located. And there will be other types of assistance available, and that information will be available soon. It's not up yet, I don't believe, but it'll be available soon on healthcare.gov.
Let me ask you this, and again, you know, I understand that some things are maybe not finalized yet, but I know for a lot of people, it helps if you can, you know, kind of run through a sample test or, you know, run through a sample configuration. If I try this and then select that, what's the outcome versus trying this other, and then with that, you know, so kind of a try A versus try B versus try C. Do you know, to the best of your knowledge, is there, you know, some modeling options like, you know, you can select A, B, and D versus A, B, and G. Is there that kind of selecting from one from column A, one from column B in that process?
I have not gotten that down into the nitty-gritty details yet. My understanding is that people will be able to get a very good picture of what these benefits look like and how they compare. So my understanding is that people will be able to have that level of detail, but I haven't gotten into it quite yet.
Oh, sure. That's certainly understandable. I'm sure that there are programmers and policy wonks at work even as we speak trying to work out all those details.
Yes, there are.
Let me ask you this. The navigators, you know, I'm trying to look at this from the average person's perspective. Are these people they'll be able to talk to, or is this a, let me be frank, a complicated press 1 to continue, press 3 for this, press 4 for that, recorded voices? Are there people going to be navigators, or is it going to be kind of a system? Do you know?
Well, the navigators are actual people.
Good.
To be trained. They're going to be going through a training process, and there are, you know, background checks and fingerprinting and all those types of things required for navigators, because they'll be collecting information from people. And then there is the call number on the healthcare.gov where people can also call to ask questions, and there will be multiple languages available and all types of ways that people can access this information. So there will be real people involved with this process.
That's super, because, you know, if there's anything, I'm involved in technology professionally, and if there's one thing that I hear, you know, complaints about help systems, when people have to deal with automated systems, they can be very, their tolerance for frustration can be very, very low. So that's really good news to hear. So this system is going to help walk people into that so they can make intelligent decisions. And obviously, I think I've heard that if you already have existing insurance, it's not going to impact, except maybe extend some rules that you didn't have before. So people who have existing insurance, I'm sure there's a few of them out there still, they won't be losing their, this won't impact their insurance, but this is for primarily for people who just don't have access.
That's absolutely correct, and there are a lot of myths out there around that very thing that you brought up, but yes, this will not impact people that already have coverage.
You know, I remember following the legislative system, the legislature of Florida, God bless them, while they were not prepared to give Floridians any health care, they certainly get a good deal on their health care insurance. While I suppose we can expect continued foolishness from some conservatives in government, is there, can you tell, a long-term path? I mean, are there going to be, we hope, more benefits and more cost control? I realize there are some cost controls, right?
There are some things that are built into the Affordable Care Act that are extremely important, that require insurance companies to spend a certain amount of money on direct care. And if they don't do it, they have to issue rebate checks, which has already been going on, which is pretty amazing. This is for small businesses and for individuals. And we saw a very big decrease in this amount of rebate money happened this past year, which tells us that it's working. I mean, insurance companies have to follow this law. It's called medical loss ratio, and it means that they have to provide a certain level of care. So it's another very important piece that's built into the Affordable Care Act.
And as I understand it, children have a great opportunity to be covered more than has been in the past. Could you talk about how this works for children, for children's health care benefits?
I can. There are some really wonderful health care programs already in place for Florida through the Florida Kid Care Program, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program. Our biggest issue that we run into with children, because many of them do qualify, is that a lot of people are unaware of that these health care programs are available. So much of what we're working on that front is trying to educate families and make sure that people know, because we have about 575,000 children. So what's very important about the marketplace and the Affordable Care Act implementation is that what we know is that when parents have coverage, children are much more likely to have coverage too. They're much more likely to visit the doctor. It is family coverage. And so it's extremely important that we get as many adults as we possibly can, because the marketplace will be a streamlined spot to also screen children for the kid care program. So it's very, very important in that it's going to provide family coverage and pick up many of these children that have not been covered yet.
When we think about children's coverage, I know a lot of times, once upon a time, there used to be some health care available through the schools. Are the schools going to have information on coverage for children?
Yes, that's a very good question. There are a lot of efforts already underway for a long time now to make sure that schools know what's available for kids, and we're just making sure that the navigators are able to get that information out and the organizations are getting the information out. So there's a lot of partnering going on with the schools, yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I understand that there are some changes through the Affordable Health Care Act that impact hospitals and clinics. Could I ask you to cover that, or is that outside the area that you focus on?
No, I can speak a little bit to that. You know, as of now, hospitals are required to treat anyone that comes in, and so this has been difficult because it's extremely expensive. A lot of people want to blame the Affordable Care Act for the increase in premiums and some of the things that we're seeing, even though the ACA has not been fully implemented yet. But the fact of the matter is that when you've got uninsured people using the hospital for basic health care, it is very expensive for everyone. So part of the design of the Affordable Care Act is that a lot of the people that are used to going to the emergency room now will have access to a doctor and have some of these primary care issues taken care of. So we're hoping that that's going to ease some of the financial burden on the hospitals.
Well, that's wonderful. Tell me, I'm looking at your website, and I see that there's been, in 2013, a Medicaid expansion campaign. Is this part of the money that the state of Florida legislature turned down, or is some of that actually going to be available to Floridians?
It's a very, very good question. So the Affordable Care Act, aside from the marketplace, also originally had an expansion of Medicaid, and it's up to 138% of the federal poverty level, and it was supposed to work together with the marketplace. And what happened is that the Supreme Court, when they ruled and upheld most of the Affordable Care Act, they decided to make the Medicaid expansion part optional. So most people listening have probably heard a whole lot about this in the news. Some states are saying yes, and some states are saying no. Sadly, after many efforts, a serious, amazing, bipartisan fight last session, I've never seen people come together the way that they did in my 12 or 13 years of doing this. We were not able to get the Medicaid expansion through. And it was very unfortunate because, like I said, we had a real strong bipartisan showing of support to draw this federal money down. It would impact about 700,000 Floridians, well, the 700,000 other people that will not be able to access tax credits in the marketplace. But it is actually 1.2 million Floridians would be impacted by this. So we were unable to make this happen, but the fight goes on, the battle wages on, the opportunity has not passed us by. So I want to explain what I just said about the marketplace. So tax credits and assistance are available, but they are not available for people under 100% of the federal poverty level. So what that means is this Medicaid expansion eligible group is also not able to use the marketplace to help to purchase coverage and would otherwise not have the ability to do so. So it's absolutely unfair and doesn't make any sense when we've got so many people on board, from the hospitals to the businesses, name it. So we are just continuing to fight that fight. We think it's extremely important, and frankly, it's been very political that it hasn't happened. There's not a very good reason at all whatsoever.
Yeah, beyond the politics.
There's really not. The federal government would be picking up the tab for the first 3 years, and then even after that, the state only has to pay not a huge amount. It's up to 10%. And like I just said about the hospitals, we know that there will be cost savings in the future for our state because this group of people still has to, likely go to the emergency room for care. So this is an extremely important campaign. There are a lot of people on board, and I invite the Floridians and your listeners to become part of the campaign with us. Our website is floridachain.org. We are always looking for volunteers. We're always looking for stories. We really like to illustrate. Here is the reality. We are talking about hardworking families. We're talking about people that get up every day and go to work and still cannot go to the doctor when they're sick.
Absolutely.
So we're very interested in story collection, and we invite people to check out the website, floridachain.org, and the other website is healthcareforflorida.org. Which is our campaign website, Healthcare for Florida Now campaign website.
If you have a couple more minutes, I would love to cover a couple other areas with you. I see that there is a new statewide long-term care program that's being rolled out.
Yes.
That's under your, the Medicaid portion of your website. And I'm sure that many people would be very happy to hear that there is increased access to health care for seniors. As you pointed out, so many people have been for a long time not been able to make themselves available to health care, and that's a real shame. Let's see, if we as we get closer to the rollout, obviously there'll be a press campaign. How, I'm sure you're using a lot of different avenues for outreach. Are you guys going to be running PSAs, I presume, and print ads as well?
Not for a chain per se, but we have many partners that will be doing advertising to make sure that information is getting out there. We're working closely with Enroll America. We're working closely with SEIU and many other partners. So there will be information getting out that way, and we do quite a bit of work with the media. And they've been very helpful in getting out information about upcoming events, make sure that they're covering the events. Florida Chain specifically will be working on enrollment fairs all around the state, where we'll be inviting people to come, and we'll have navigators on site. So all that information will be on our website soon. And we will be working with the press to get the information out about those events. So that's more of a chain-specific project.
Sure. If you don't mind, I would like to ask you a couple personal questions. So many of us involved in political affairs or civic affairs, we kind of have the same sort of thing happen to us. We're involved in trying to make a living and have a family and, maintain friends and have a little fun in this world. But activists have this thing happen in their hearts or have this thing happen in their lives where they have to be involved. They have to take that additional time to be engaged in their community. What was it in your life that made you an activist, that gave you the impetus to go beyond merely just having a job and a family?
a great question. Well, my family, thank you to my family, really did a great job of just building empathy really early with all of us. I've got three sisters, and I remember having a great deal of empathy pretty early on. So some of this comes from my upbringing. But I think what really did it is right out of college, right out of undergrad, I had a job working with children with severe behavioral disorders.
Wow.
And I would go into the, it was very tough, and I would go into the homes and I would help the families try to work with these kids. A lot of the kids were foster care kids, they were in the system, they had been abused. And what I really witnessed firsthand, just right there, hands-on, was poverty. So I have a great deal of interest in that, because what I really feel like I saw was human suffering in a country that's wealthy and a place where we have resources, and really it's about making the right decisions on how to help people. So I figured out pretty early that, and I had a mentor say to me, you know, I'm not sure. I think it might be public policy or legislative advocacy or law school or something like that for you. And I started looking into it, and she was right. I realized we can make an impact on a larger scale and impact more people kind of going this legislative advocacy route. But I have those children and families in my mind still every day, because it was unbelievable. And I think in terms of healthcare, it really has been a system of haves and have-nots. I mean, we hear that phrase a lot. It's very real. I had someone say to me the other day, well, I mean, if they can't, you know, they can't get health insurance and they can just fall over in the bushes outside of the ER, they should just pay for it, get a job and pay for it. And, you know, it hurts my heart to hear people talking like that, because, like I said, the reality is people work very hard and still cannot afford to have health care. So I believe very much in this issue. I believe in this law. Nothing's perfect, but it is extremely important and it needs to work well. And that's some of what has brought me into this world of activism.
Well, thank you so much for the work that you do, and I know the kind of person that you are. Your family benefits from the work that you do in the world, too. Thank you so much,
Leah.
Thank
you.
I really appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
I hope you'll come back again and tell us even more about the rollout of these healthcare systems. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And now a rollout of another kind.
Turkish police have reportedly detained several members of the Al-Nusra Front, a jihadist group that's fighting among the Syrian rebels against the Assad government. The men were apparently on their way to the Syrian border, transporting a cylinder of Zarian nerve gas. Live to RT's Middle East correspondent, now Paul Slier, for more on this. Paul, what more can you tell us about these arrests, and specifically, how do they tie in with Western concerns over the use of chemical weapons in Syria?
Well, Turkish Special Anti-Terror Forces have detained 12 people. That's what we know. They are suspected of having links with the Al-Nusra Front, which is the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Syrian rebel group aimed at toppling the Syrian President Bashar Assad. Now, the group was seized in southern Turkey, and that is according to local media reports. The media also saying that they carried a 2-kilogram cylinder with the nerve agent sarin. Now, Turkish authorities haven't yet commented on this report, and we are waiting to hear from them. Britain, the United States, and France in the past have said that they believe it is Assad, however, that is using chemical weapons, but they haven't been able to produce any kind of evidence to prove this. The British government has written to the United Nations Ban Ki-moon alleging 3 new incidents of chemical use by Assad's forces, and at the same time, the French government says that it is testing samples that were smuggled out by journalists. But all of this is hearsay at the moment, whereas on the other hand, we have here what we're seeing is fighters from the Al-Nusra Front allied with the Syrian rebels caught with the sarin nerve agent gas. It is important also to point out and remind our viewers that the United Nations in the past launched an independent investigation, and that did conclude that there are signs that the rebels have been using this sarin nerve agent. Now, Damascus is supportive of an investigation, but not one that will lead to an Iraqi type of scenario. The use of chemical weapons is banned under international law, and there are concerns that any kind of suggestions or any kind of proof of their use will trigger international intervention.
Well, Paula, what is the attitude among rebels towards the international peace efforts to resolve the crisis in Syria?
The Syrian National Coalition has said that it will not take part in U.S.-Russia-sponsored talks that are scheduled to take place in Geneva next month. The condition that they have for participating is that Iran and Hezbollah renounce all involvement in the Syrian conflict, and only if they do they say that they will attend those talks. This statement does follow the Syrian army's advances in the central part of the country. But with the European Union's arms embargo now lifted, some think that the rebels may try to gain the upper hand on the ground. Now, all of this is happening while the first batch of Russian anti-aircraft missiles arrives in Syria.
And there we have it. Russian missiles on the way to Syria. The Turkish forces find Al-Qaeda-linked rebel smuggling sarin gas into Syria. Stranger and stranger. And yet, there's this news from the Korean Peninsula.
Now, although the Japanese government has vowed to come up with measures to tackle the radioactive water leak, the situation may be worse than thought. Studies from last year indicate that radioactive water will contaminate the entire Pacific Ocean in just 6 years. Kim Min-ji reports.
This graphic shows the gradual contamination of the Pacific Ocean due to leaks of radioactive water from the crippled Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan. The simulation, which was run by a German marine research institute, shows the entire Pacific waters being polluted by radioactive water in just 6 years. Although the results failed to grab attention when first released last year, experts now fear that the hypothesis may become a scary reality after the Japanese government recently admitted that some 300 tons of radioactive water have leaked into the ocean. Misei Murata, a former Japanese ambassador to Switzerland, criticized the Japanese government and the operator of the crippled nuclear plant, Tokyo Electric Power Corporation, for its handling of the situation.
TECO recently admitted to leaks of radioactive water. The amount is much more than the simulation had taken into account.
The international community has also voiced concerns over the issue, but Tokyo, meanwhile, is busy drumming up support for its bid in hosting the 2020 Olympics.
2020 Tokyo, let's do well.
Yes, the Japanese plan for the coming years is let's do well in the Olympics. Well, all I can say is the way that we should go nature's way.
Nature's weak.
Well, it seems that there's a little technical difficulty with the phone system tonight. So instead of our little chat about the peace breaking out in Syria, let me bring you this interview that we haven't yet aired. It's Tangerine Bolin, one of the plaintiffs in the suit of Chris Hedges and some other activists opposing the NDAA, that case where they said that freedom of association has basically been made illegal, and the court has ruled they have no standing because they have no reason to believe they're being spied on.
And that's a real disgrace.
Can you talk about the Bradley Manning Support Network, what you've been doing, Nathan? The family of Bradley Manning just issued a statement, and in it has thanked the Bradley Manning Support Network, the kind of activism that has gone on around his case and who is involved.
Sure, we've been involved since his very inception, since Bradley's arrest. We've raised more than $1 million for Bradley's legal defense and to keep the support network going. We try to raise awareness not only around the country, but around the world. This is a case of international interest. We have dozens and dozens of solidarity events anytime we hold a rally, and we send out materials for that. We want to keep Bradley in the public interest because the mainstream media is largely blocked out from this trial. We have no audio or video recording, and so it's very difficult for a lot of these bigger outlets to cover it.
I also want to say that as we do this live stream at democracynow.org, we're showing the illustrations of Clark Stokely. Now, it was a fascinating scene to see this WikiLeaks truck drive up every day and this illustrator get out onto the base, right, where
it
you're at,
like
the National Security Agency. That's where the trial has taken place.
So let me go ahead and share this other one with you. I think is a little more important. The news regarding Chelsea Manning is that's a little older. But this is something that stands the test of time. This is Thomas Drake, one of the whistleblowers at the press club.
2 years ago, our guest today was accused by the U.S. Justice Department of espionage. The Air Force veteran and longtime senior executive at the National Security Agency was accused of giving classified documents to a news reporter. Thomas Drake faced 35 years in prison. A year later, on the eve of his trial, the government dropped all felony charges against Mr. Drake. He has since been honored as a whistleblower who helped to expose waste and fraud at the spy agency and to bring to light its massive effort to spy on Americans' own citizens. Mr. Drake's ordeal began coincidentally on September 11, 2001, which happened to be his first day as a full-time employee of the NSA. Like all other U.S. intelligence agencies, the NSA had missed key pieces of information that might have tipped off the government that the terrorist attacks were imminent. Shortly after 9/11, Mr. Drake came to believe that the agency could have predicted the attacks if it had made use of a surveillance system known as Thin Thread that could sift through massive amounts of data and detect patterns and key information. Instead, NSA leaders turned to outside contractor SAIC to build a new data collection system called Trailblazer that cost more than $1 billion, 10 times the cost of Thin Thread. At the same time, Mr. Drake learned that the agency was turning its surveillance capabilities on American citizens, which he believed was a violation of the U.S. Constitution. He decided to speak up. Mr. Drake reported his concerns about money wasted on Trailblazer and about domestic surveillance to Congress and to the Defense Department's Inspector General. He became a material witness in two 9/11 congressional investigations. Even after the Inspector General found that the Trailblazer project was a massive waste and the program was killed, little changed at the NSA. Mr. Drake then decided to go public. He brought his information about the problems with Trailblazer to a Baltimore Sun reporter who wrote a series of articles exposing the waste. Mr. Drake insists he did not reveal any classified information. Yet, when the New York Times in 2005 reported the stunning news that the U.S. government was tapping into its citizens' telephone calls with no warrants, Mr. Drake became a target in one of the most aggressive leak investigations in history. Agents raided his home in 2007, took his computers and files, and threatened that he could spend the rest of his life in prison. In 2010, the Justice Department indicted Mr. Drake for, quote, willful retention of classified documents. It was only the fourth time in history that a citizen was charged with espionage for mishandling documents. A conviction could have had a chilling effect on whistleblowers and on journalists who often receive and keep defense documents. Morton Halperin of the Open Society Institute said Mr. Drake's prosecution, quote, poses a grave threat to the mechanism by which we learn what the government does. Instead, the government's case fell apart when the government found no evidence that Mr. Drake willfully leaked classified information. Mr. Drake's sentencing judge said the prosecution was, quote, not proper. It does not pass the smell test. Thomas Drake now writes, speaks, and teaches about whistleblowing, constitutional rights, and abuse of government power. He's the recipient of the 2011 Ridenour Truth-Telling Prize and the 2011 Sam Adams Associates Integrity and Excellence Award. As we wrap up Sunshine Week here at the National Press Club, please help me give a warm welcome to Thomas Drake.
I'd like to thank the National Press Club for inviting me here. I'm looking forward to the Q&A, so I do have a few remarks to kind of set the tone and the tenor and to reflect quite in a sobering manner on what happened to me and what's at stake for this country. I've entitled my remarks, In the Shadowlands of the Secrecy State, Preying on the First Amendment. I first want to announce, however, that I can neither confirm nor deny that a solar eclipse cast by the shadow government is at least partially blocking the view of Sunshine Week. To do either might just reveal state secrets to reporters and journalists, including those of you in the room, unauthorized to receive them. And I would not want you all to end up with allegedly classified information regarding the weather in Washington, D.C. The White House blog on Wednesday said, quote, we celebrate Sunshine Week, an appropriate time to discuss the importance of open government and freedom of information, including a quote from President Obama saying, quote, openness will strengthen our democracy and promote efficiency and effectiveness in government. Really? Justin Radak, the National Security and Human Rights Director at the Government Accountability Project, remarked on Twitter just yesterday that after, quote, 3 years of shouting into the wilderness, unquote, she is relieved to see that the Kool-Aid crowd is finally realizing that the Obama administration's draconian orgy of secrecy is finally reaching a boiling point. Glenn Greenwald with the Guardian newspaper published a very powerful article yesterday titled, quote, Obama's secrecy fixation causing Sunshine Week implosion. I'd like to remind everybody that President John F. Kennedy said that the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. I'd like to think that we have reached a critical event horizon. And whether national security as a new state religion will further suck the dwindling light of the First Amendment into the black hole of classification and secrecy hidden from public view. It seems that secrecy is actually strengthening the national security state in order to hide from accountability and oversight at the expense of informed public interest, where it matters the most. What is the price of keeping the public in the dark and having a government increasingly operating in the dark through secret law or interpretations in secret of existing law? After all, this very event is part of Sunshine Week, and I would like to highlight just one event that brings the message of Sunshine Week home regarding what's so at stake and our increasingly two-faced government. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee held hearings this week on addressing transparency in the federal bureaucracy, moving toward a more open government. The larger theme of the testimony before that committee centered on the inherent tension between the president's pledge for a new era of unprecedented.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me bring on one of my live guests to talk peace and war. Sandy, welcome.
Yeah, hi, Rick.
This is Sandy Davies, leader of Progressive Democrats of America in Miami. Sandy, do you have a formal title, brother?
leader of the Miami chapter of Progressive Democrats of America. Is that formal enough?
That's fantastic. That is fantastic. Hold on one second. Let me check. I've got somebody who the phone system's been dead all night. Let me see who I've got here. Good evening. Welcome. Who's this?
Good evening. It's Brian Stetton. Was that Sandy? Hi, Sandy.
Ah, yes, it is. Oh, wonderful. So I've got you both on. Fantastic. Okay. So
good,
I've got Brian Stetton, who is one of the founders, producer of Progress Toward
Democracy.
I've got Sandy Davies from Miami and PDA. Gentlemen, first, let me ask you, Sandy. Sandy, does the president need the support of the American people and their representatives in Congress to go off and start blowing somebody up?
Well, I guess it depends what consequences he might expect from doing that and what kind of authority he might believe that he has to do that. But as I told a local TV news person at a rally in Miami today, nobody has appointed the United States or the President of the United States as the enforcer of international law to respond to chemical weapons attacks. That is a role under, you know, the current international system that is reserved to the United Nations Security Council.
Let me ask Brian that same.
And the United States is particularly unqualified to assume that role by the fact that we have failed to prosecute our own war criminals and our own violators of international law who have committed torture and who illegally invaded Iraq 10 years ago. And so how on earth the United States government can take upon itself, you know, the mantle of the enforcer of international or the upholder of the international order is certainly beyond me. And I think it's beyond most of the population of the world. Now, whether that is also beyond the grasp of the so-called representatives who are supposed to represent us in Congress, we will find out in the coming week. And I think it's very important that all of us call our members of Congress and let them know how we feel.
Thanks. Let me ask Brian that same question. Brian, has the authority landed on President Obama's desk that he can go ahead and be the world's cop or the world's mercenary?
Well, I mean, that hasn't stopped us before. I don't see. I mean, he certainly can. It's a matter of whether he should. And, of course, we believe he definitely should not, because it would simply kill innocent people in Syria. So it's outrageous. I mean, it would be a war crime if we did. It would unilateral action against a country in which we're not, you know, being attacked ourselves. But, I mean, it's not the first time we've done that. We have a history of doing that. You know, so if you look, every president since every post-war president has committed a war crime in one sense or another. So, yeah. There's an article I strongly recommend. It was mentioned briefly in a talk by Chomsky decades ago, which you can easily Google. Called We Are the World's Guardians. If you just Google We Are the World's Guardians Chicago Tribune, and this article that was published in September 9th, 1990 by William Niekirk will pop up. He was their business editor. And it's a very honest article where the guy states, the last bastion of our economics is our military. We've poured all our wealth in our military, and we've made sure that we have maintained a monopoly on security power that no other country can come close to touching. You know, no Federal Trade Commission can break it up. This is the largest monopoly in the world, and we intend to always use it. And other countries refer to us as Hessians. You know, the Hessians were basically mercenaries. You know, during the American Revolutionary War, you had the German army was basically hired by the British to fight us during the American Revolutionary War. And basically, we have become the world's Hessians. Yeah, and rather
Let
than...
Let me ask you a question, gentlemen, if I may. It seems that you keep hearing this appeal to international law and international norms. I think invasion or lobbing missiles in there for justice's sake fails both tests. If we're talking about justice, if we're talking about the international law, well, you don't solve a law problem by blowing somebody up. You take them to court. You go to the world court. You go to an international body and say, these people need to be tried. They violated international law. And if the problem is, you know, this is a violation of normal standards, well, you know, we've been a very large part in providing poisonous gases to those countries in the past. So our hands are by far not clean. Do you think there's any chance of stopping this onslaught, this rush to war? Brian, let me ask you that same question first, and then I'll ask you, Sandy.
Yeah, it matters how powerful the other influences are that are pushing us into it. I mean, I would say the majority are dead set against it. Even the Egyptian military is against it. The Egyptian military is against the Muslim Brotherhood, and you have Muslim Brotherhood supporters of rebels in Syria. The leader of the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood said last year, oh, the Assad regime will fall in months. At that time, we, our own State Department said that Assad was among the walking dead. I mean, boy, we've been certainly wrong about that. Assad proved to be fairly strong, actually. Basically, it's been a stalemate there ever since. The biggest supporter of military action is in Saudi Arabia, for example. Prince Bandar?
Bin Soldar.
Yep, thank you. He's aggressively lobbying for the U.S. to take military action. I think a year ago he was training some of the rebels with the CIA in some training camp in Jordan close to the Syrian border.
And, let me ask Sandy that same question.
Yeah,
Sandy,
yeah.
Do you think there's a chance to stop President Obama in his rush to send missiles to Syria to solve a court case?
You know, I think the answer to that question depends on how we perceive our own power, or the power of the American people. I think with enough of an outcry from the American people, the so-called representatives in Congress, enough of them might feel compelled to take a stand against this. But I think that's really up to us. So as Bob Dylan said in that song a long time ago, the wheel's still in spin. And it could be, you know, we can always hope that this could be the moment where the sleeping giant of the American public finally wakes up and the dormant but ever-potent virus of democracy spreads through this land. And, you know, if I thought that was impossible, I wouldn't do what I do. It's possible. And, you know, whether this will be the moment that it happens or not, we will find out.
Let me try to get one more question in for both of you. I'll start with you, Sandy, this time first. Be as brief as you can. We've only got 7 minutes. Do you think there's a chance for the extreme, for the right wing and the left wing to come together on this? Neither of them trust the president. Is there a chance that this a coalition of the right and the left can come together?
Yes, that's definitely possible. It's happened in small ways already. And as I told my member of Congress's legislative director a few weeks ago, you know, what the sort of mainstream leadership of the Democratic Party may be confronting is in fact that the principled left and the principled left country will come together against the unprincipled, interest-driven so-called center.
Excellent.
Which controls both parties.
Thank you. Thank you. Brian, same question.
I agree with Sandy, as I usually do. I mean, we almost had both parties were very divided on the NSA, and we almost saw Congress push forward a bill to defund the NSA without anything being officially put to the floor by the Speaker. I mean, that was amazing that that occurred at all. This is an issue that's much more inflammatory. So actually, it's very conceivable. I would give it a 50-50 chance that Congress might disapprove of the president, and we would have some unity between portions of both parties.
Excellent. Well, guys, we're coming down to the last 5 minutes of the show. First, before I let you make a final comment, I have to say this. I want to salute my fellow progressive broadcasters, Gwen Holden-Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters, my good friend and guest tonight, Brian Stetton, and his show, Progress
Thank
Toward
you.
Democracy, which is on when, Brian?
Monday nights at 10 o'clock.
Excellent.
Although not tomorrow night, because
okay.
Roseanne's off somewhere, but we'll be back next week with you as a guest.
Okay. And we've got Susan Nylon of her show, The Nylon Report, our good friend Anita Stewart and her show, Wise Women Media, Harriet Lehrman and her show, The Voice, and our friend Sita Bigwill and her show called Sita Media. So with those things taken care of, my good fellow broadcasters supported, let me ask you both to make a concluding remark, and I'll go with you, Brian, first.
Well, there was an article that got published on the 27th by The Guardian, which basically described how the elites of Syria were already getting out of there, getting put in the front of the line, and were very well-dressed and so forth. And I mean, basically, if we strike Syria, it's just going to kill poor working-class people, and which is those are the ones that always get hurt in a military action. It's just got to be stopped at all costs. They're the ones that suffer.
Thank you. And Sandy?
Well, I think since the very beginning, the United States and its allies have escalated the violence in Syria. They undermined Kofi Annan's plan in 2012 by refusing to use their influence over the people that they have supported in Syria, who are also linked to Al-Qaeda. And so since the U.S. proxies in Syria started to lose this war that they started at the instigation of all these foreign powers, the U.S. has been looking for a pretext to do what they did in Libya and effectively become the air force of the al-Nusra Front. And, of course, the first step in that would be to destroy Syria's air defenses, very substantial Russian-built air defenses. And I believe, frankly, that all of this very questionable rhetoric about chemical weapons is simply a pretext to do just that, to launch missile strikes, destroy Syria's air defenses, so that the U.S. can become more involved in this war. And so as I said before, please call your member of Congress this week and ask them to vote for peace.
Well, thank you
Agreed.
Both, you gentlemen, for joining us. Yeah, go ahead,
Agreed.
Brian.
No, I agree. I agree. Definitely. Call your member of Congress. Vote for peace. Completely agree.
I saw a statement on Facebook just a few minutes ago. Our friend Steve Malagodi is quoting Senator Nelson, who is all for this. My goodness, there's important money that can be made. So thank you both, gentlemen, for joining me tonight. Next week, Progressive News Network brings you union news and a Labor Day festival. So thanks so much, gentlemen. You guys take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Good night.
Okay.
Good night, everybody.
Bye bye, gentlemen.
Bye, Sandy. Bye, Richard.
Bye-bye. Okay, so let's go with we'll go out with a little bit of music, and we'll. We'll remind you that
it's
a piece called Open Your Eyes.
Wow. Next week. We have our guests. Miss Anna Escobani. College Democrat. Unfortunately, the phone system has thwarted us from having our special guests saved. Rebecca Marquez, Lord Kane, talking about healthcare. Alan Mack, labor organizer from the West, talking about peace and war. Miss Leah Barbara Hines talking about healthcare, and both Mr. Brian Dead talks about democracy in San Diego. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next week for the Union Festival. Bye-bye.